After 40 years of being in the Middle East, I'm not really good at speaking in English in front of a crowd. So if I get stuck, it means I'm trying to think, now what was that word in English? I'm at the age now where I'm trying to understand my compulsions. A particular chocolate bar is compelling to me. All right? It should have those little coffee nibs in it. All right? And it should be fair trade. I mean, I have a lot of criteria for my chocolate bar that compels me. And if we happen to have a chocolate bar in the house, it kind of burns a hole in the back of my mind until I just eat it. And I always tell myself, I will eat half of it now and half of it later. But now and later get compressed into now. So you get compulsions, right? Trying to understand my compulsions. And I try to understand, is Jesus compelling to me? Does he compel me? What would that look like? What would that feel like if I were compelled by Jesus? I have another interest. I don't know if it's compelling, but it's about time. The film Back to the Future, and then Back to the Future 2, and then Back to the Future 3, and then there's Doctor Who, and there's time machines. I'm fascinated by time, but apparently our culture is too. How do we get control of time? Because if you are in control of time, you are a master of the universe. I'm sure that Jesus is in control of time. But how? I mean, he's kind of like, sometimes Jesus is like Gandalf. You know, Gandalf the great wizard, you know. And sometimes he has the compulsion of Aragorn, son of Arathorn. Any Tolkien freaks in the room? Good, all right. And sometimes he's as compelling as Harry Potter, where you'll lose sleep because of Harry Potter. You know, I promise myself I'll only read one more chapter, right? Five chapters later. So I took a trip into the Gospel of Mark for about 3 months, and I found some places that you could beam Scotty up into, okay? It's places where the world of time and the world of not time cross. And one of them comes from Matthew chapter 9, verses 2 to 4, and we called this the Transfiguration. When I read the Transfiguration, it's like, wow. These two dudes come down and everybody shines, and Peter doesn't know what to say, so he kind of makes an idiot of himself. And then a voice happens, and then you move on with the rest of the New Testament and you think, I don't understand that. Let's get on to something that I understand. Transfiguration? All the shining robes and stuff. So I decided I better sit here for about a month reading and thinking and discussing in my head what the Bible would say about it. So Moses and Elijah appear to talk to Jesus. And do you remember what they're talking about? They're talking about Jesus' departure. They're talking about Jesus' exodus. Well, Moses did an exodus, right? Because every time you think of exodus, you think of Moses. Exodus, the great salvation of God's people. But Elijah had his own exodus. The chariots and the horsemen of Israel, and he goes off in a blaze of glory. And then there's Jesus waiting for his departure. And I thought, okay, I get this. When I'm with people and my friend has had gallbladder surgery and I've had eye surgery and somebody else has had foot surgery, what do we talk about? My surgery was better than your surgery, okay? Or my surgery was longer. So it's like a thing that's going to be talked about because it's the thing that's in common. Moses' exodus, Elijah's exodus, Jesus is going to exit or exodus. Of course they would talk about that. Moses' Exodus was absolute redemption from slavery. Now remember, this is going on in some other time-space thing, right? It's not happening in the time that Peter understands. Something opened up and Obi-Wan Kenobi would come through at any moment. You know, this is otherworldly. So big discussion about absolute redemption from slavery. And Elijah, the absolute negation of death. He didn't die. Went up in that chariot. And then Jesus says, and if you're interested, Elijah, John the Baptist, is kind of Elijah, if you can accept it. So who is John the Baptist? So you look back, I'm living in the Middle East for 40 years. You want to know whose great-grandfather, you know, who's his great-grandfather? That tells you a lot about who he is. And I remembered then that John is a Levite from the tribe of Levi, and he's a descendant of Aaron because Zechariah and Elizabeth are descendants of Aaron. So John should have been in the temple. And what should he have been doing as a Levite in the temple? Purifying offerings before they're offered to God. Purifying people who want to come before God. That's what they scrubbed you down before they let you in. That's what Levites do, or did, or will do again. So John is there, the voice in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Amazing. This is going to come up again, so just keep that icon open in your brain, right? The transfiguration icon. And then there's always a question. So we have the out-of-world experience and a question. Why does Elijah have to come first, say the disciples? And if you know anything from reading the disciples, they're really not very sharp. It takes a lot of repetition. And fortunately for us, it does, because I'm actually slower than they are, right? So they're just not, they're not the brightest spark. They're not the, what is it, the brightest light on the Christmas tree? You know, they're just kind of normal dudes who don't get it. So why does Elijah come first? He comes to restore or to purify all things and to fulfill all righteousness, to make everything just right so that it's acceptable to God. That's why John came. So keep that thought. Remember, you got to keep this icon open of this transfiguration. But the passage moves on, and you go down the hill from the transfiguration, and what do you run into? Verse 14. An argument. Now, in the Middle East, we really have the art of argument perfected. Okay? I haven't lived in the States recently for 40 years. I don't know how Minnesotans argue. Do you get especially quiet? You know, do you clench your fists? I don't know how people who are nice do that, okay? But I know how we do it in the Middle East, and it's a lot of hand-waving and loud noises and choices of words that are not offensive, but abrasive. Because you can whisper an offensive word in Arabic, and people will draw into guns and knives, and it's over, right? We don't want to fight. We want an argument. So we're really good at arguments. We've got it down pat. So they're having a big argument, and it's the disciples and the teachers of the law. What do you think they're arguing about? I mean, you know the issue is somebody couldn't heal a kid, right? But who's arguing? You can't do it, says the teacher of the law. And the disciple says, and you can't either. And the teacher of the law says, and I'll tell you why you can't do it. First of all, you're a stinky, smelly Galilean fisherman. That's what's wrong with you. And the Galilean, who is stinky and smelly because he's a fisherman, says to the teachers of the law, you guys live in an ivory tower. You have no clue. So they're arguing. And who's lying there on the ground? The boy. And who's watching all this go on? The father. So when Jesus walks up, he goes, in our kinds of language, what's up, guys? What's going on? And the father of the boy, now this, you got to understand Middle East arguments. Everybody's poised to the next new person who comes into the circle. I got to say my part first, because if I say it first and loudest, I'm going to be right. So before anybody can say anything, the father of the son says, I brought my son to your guys and they couldn't do it. Lame. They couldn't do it. What does Jesus say? Bring him here. Now the other world opens and the demon sees Jesus. You know those guys can see us, right? But they can only see us if we're in their viewfinder. In Mark 3, verse 11, it says, whenever they saw him, the demons shouted, you are the Son of the Most High. And Jesus says, cool it. It's not time. So they can see us, but they can't see us except in their viewfinder. They're not omnipotent, is that right? Omniscient. They can't see everything and know everything. So they see him. And the demon throws the kid into a convulsion. If you're a card-carrying demon in good standing with the union of demons, why would you do that? Why would you throw a kid into a convulsion? Diversion, perhaps. You know, keep the focus over here, not on me, the demon. Or it could be desperation. Because the demon knows who Jesus is. So you've got to do something to divert, be desperate. Jesus says, how long has this been going on? We would say to the father, are you okay with this? It's been going on for some time. You know, are you okay with this? And then the father does something really weird. He says, I'm not okay, but I don't know what to do. The teachers of the law couldn't do anything for my boy. Your disciples couldn't do anything for my boy. I believe, but help me. Help my unbelief. So Jesus rebukes him, the demon. He shrieks. He does one last little thing, convulses the boy, and he's gone. What a remarkable thing that things from that world can see us. And only rarely can we actually grasp that they're the ones doing it and how desperately we need Christ. But the question, so, and this happened after hours at home in closed, behind closed doors, and the disciples said to Jesus privately, because we, you know, it's like we couldn't do it in public. We need to clean up our act here a bit, Jesus. Why couldn't we do that? And he says, well, I've got a clue for you. It's by prayer. Not by power. Not by pride. It's prayer. It's not about focusing on winning in this world. It's the focus on seeing into another reality. People need healing. God heals. I don't need to argue with the Pharisee, or the Pharisee argue with me. That's why you couldn't drive it out, guys. Your game is too small. So these are amazing thoughts for me, right? You see Jesus talking with Moses and Elijah, and you realize what an enormous discussion that would have been. And then one of the outcomes is that this is the voice in the wilderness. This is who John is. This is the purifying Levite. In other words, the sacrifice that's coming, you got to be ready for. There's never been one like it before, and there will never be a need for one again. The second peep into a reality outside of time is that we reach that reality because I ask God who lives out there. He doesn't live in time. He lives outside of my world, but it's real. It's real out there. Then a third one. It's another argument. So the A side note from Mark 10, 34 and 35, James and John come up to Jesus and say, do we have a, you know, there's a thing, right hand, left hand, us, Jesus. And Jesus says, well, it's not for me to say. But when the disciples heard that James and John had done that, what did they feel? Indignation. What drives indignation? I should have had that. I don't think they're upset that James and John are acting like nerds. I think that they're thinking, I didn't get there first. How can they do that? And of course, James and John have a very interesting reason to do this, because they were at the Transfiguration with Peter. Peter, James, and John. So they see Peter, he talks, and they think, well, Peter's going to win here, so we've got to pad our, what do you say in English? We've got to cover our own base, you know. So fortunately, the Bible lets us see just how off the disciples are, because I can be off too. So big argument, and the argument is over, which one of us is the greatest? Big concern. We've seen the Transfiguration. Nothing like this has ever happened before. It's totally out of world. It's out of time. It's like magic, right? And we've seen a demon recognize Jesus, and Jesus simply rebuke him and say, it doesn't have to be like this. And what's our big concern? Who's on first? It's a zero-sum situation, guys. I got to win, you got to lose. Remarkable disciples. Just like me. Arguing who is the greatest. So in Matthew, Mark chapter 9:33-36, Jesus comes and he sets a child in their presence. And he says, the kingdom of God is like this child. And I like to think of it as you need to be like a child to be in the kingdom. But the way you treat a child shows if you're in the kingdom. So it's a sword with two sides, two edges. The one who is greatest in the kingdom is the least. But remember, now we're going back to our first icon, that John the Baptist is Elijah who is to come. And there's nobody born of women greater than John the Baptist. Except that the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than John. What? So John is the greatest, but the least in the kingdom is greater than he. What does this mean? Here's what I think it means. This is an application, not an interpretation. Okay, I didn't go to seminary, so this is my application. When Jesus said, guys, nobody's greater than John. John is the voice. He's preparing us for something unbelievable, something phenomenal. Except that there's somebody greater than John, called the least. I think he was remembering when he became a child. I don't know that you could say that an eternal, timeless person needs a memory. I need a memory because something happened yesterday and it's happening now. But does an eternal being need a memory? So I can't really say that he remembered. I can just say that maybe he's aware, because I live in time. I can see something that's timeless, but I don't know how to describe it. So Jesus is, let's say he's recounting to himself in a timeless way. I remember when I became this child. I remember, you remember Philippians chapter 2, where he divests himself of crowns and glories and kingdoms and abilities and miracle work, and he ends up being born as a baby. I think he was thinking about that. I'm the baby, I'm the least in the kingdom of God. He humbled himself, becoming like us in human flesh. And just like a son, through his suffering, he learned obedience. Now I get why John is mentioned in all three of these places. The transfiguration, the discussion about who's greatest, this particular thing. John is here, and I'm going to read a little poem by a poet named Lucy Shaw, if any of you are familiar with Lucy. Down he came from up, in from out, a long leap, an incandescent fall from so magnificent to so naked, frail and small. Through space, between the stars, into our chill night air, shrunk in infant grace, to our damp, cramped, earthy place among all the shivering sheep. And now, after all, there he lies, fast asleep. Jesus compels me. When you see through the veils of time and his discussion with Moses and Elijah, and you see John the Baptist was his cousin even, and what John is preparing us for, this immaculate sacrifice. And then Jesus looks and he says, yes, if you want to understand the kingdom, you have to understand me. And if you want to understand me, you have to understand me as the powerless nothingness of a baby. That is so compelling. That's better than Harry Potter. I would lose sleep at night just to read about Jesus. I would compare him to Aragorn, son of Arathorn. I'll stay awake in the day just to be able to be in touch with him. As writers in a previous age, actually when this church was built more than 100 years ago, would have said, oh God, steal my heart away. He's a heart stealer. He's a heart stealer. So I just wanted to share with you this morning those three things as I looked out, tried to look outside of the time that I'm caught in to see something about Jesus, something about the spiritual reality that he lived in that compels me, impels me, creates the compulsion to me to love him. I'm sure you love him too. And that's what sticks us together like glue. Thank you.